Hi, once again, this is Poe Johnson with Within the Margins, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Terry Merrick. Do you prefer Terry or Dr. Merrick?
Terry.
Terry? Okay, great. And Terry is the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Azuka Pacific University?
Yes.
All right. So, Terry, can you just tell me, what is your research and your background and how you came to get to the research work you're doing right now?
Okay. So the research I'm doing right now is on biomedical conceptions and treatments of intersex people, especially children. And I probably need to say something about what intersex
is. Yes, absolutely.
We have what's called various biological sex markers. So whether you have a vagina or not, whether you have a clitoris or a penis, whether you're XY or XX, whether you're pumping testosterone or estrogen. So all of these are considered biological sex markers, biological criteria that we use or that are used to skip sex assignments, usually upon birth. So an intersex person is a person where those biological sex markers just don't align. So there's various kinds of situations. One would be what's called complete androgen insensitivity. So these are the ones that sometimes will make the news where someone's XY, so genetically they're male, but in embryonic development there's an androgen wash, and that androgen wash is what then tricks all the proteins where you start to develop the reproductive organs. So I could be XY, but if I'm androgen insensitive, then in embryonic development I'd be phenotypically female. So these are cases where the child actually is born phenotypically, looks female, is usually raised female. And then often, usually sometimes this comes up, so when menstruation should hit, these women will not menstruate. And that's when they'll go in and find out, oh, they're XY.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you'll get this, you'll hear this, because this will happen with athletes. So female athletes often wouldn't menstruate. If you're a triathlon, my sister's a triathlete, you won't. So it's when something happens in the Olympics where women athletes have to undergo genetic testing, and then they'll find out. So that's just one case of intersex. So one debate has been, there was a treatment protocol a while ago that was based that gender identity, now gender is not sex, but gender identity is how I experience myself.
Yes.
So a transgendered person typically is, and again, all of these,
their terms are always,
they're always up for
debate.
But transgendered is where maybe there's no question that, you know, the body is aligned all one way, say male, but I experience myself as female.
As opposed to cisgendered.
Yes, exactly. So, but in the intersex situation, it's at the biological level that there's misalignment. I don't even want to use the word misalignment. So one of the questions with intersex was what used to happen, at least in this country, was the idea that gender identity was primarily a factor of socialization. Not totally, but so. So the treatment protocol was if you had a child that was born where the reproductive, external genitalia was ambiguous, the recommendations were early genital surgery to sort of disambiguate the child, and not tell the child of the diagnosis in some sense until they were later. And the reason for this was that the idea was that if the child themselves experienced themselves as not having any gender confusion, everybody that met them, just assumed a certain, that through the socialization process and they would develop a certain fixed gender identity, male or female, and that was the optimal treatment outcome. What happened was patients that underwent this treatment protocol then became adults and really started to advocate against this treatment. Specifically against early genital reconstructions and also against the fact that they were not told often of their diagnosis. So there's been a shift in the treatment protocols, and an argument for the shift that happened in 2005, 2006, where now the term is no longer intersexed. It's called disorders of sexual development. And this came, was informed by some of these patient advocacy groups, but there's a huge debate now about whether or not the result of that, especially the change from intersex to a disorder of sexual development, actually gives us any sort of progress or actually just makes matters worse. So if the problem was intersex people were stigmatized, now saying that you're disordered sexual development seems just as stigmatized.
So correct me if I'm wrong, and this this change in the terminology came out of a conference?
Yeah, so this, it was 2005 international conference in Chicago. And again, I mean, and I don't want to sell the conference short because and there were intersex advocates there. I think there were two out of 48. And, you know, this is, I mean, to have a medical conference where you're developing treatment protocol and actually have patient advocacy groups at the table was seen at the time as, you know, incredibly welcoming and of the biomedical community really listening to patient advocacy groups, giving them a real, you know, place at the discursive table. So that's why my interest in this conference is, and the outcome of it is an interesting one to me, because even though it looked like that was happening, I think sincere intentions by all parties to have this kind of, you know, patient participation, at the end of the day, there almost immediately you had advocacy groups and advocates really upset about the outcome. And so my research has been kind of looking at that and seeing to what extent those criticisms are really correct. And I've come to think that they really are. And then examining why this happens. I think this happens so often.
It does, absolutely.
And so, yeah, go ahead.
Because it brings up a number of different questions for me. So for one, like, if you have, you said it was 2 out of 48 for advocacy groups or intersex themselves.
Right.
And then this sort of becomes the idea is like, does this mean that these two are really talking for everyone?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the other thing is also was it was fairly Eurocentric. So they, the demographic, and I'm getting the demographic from the UK Intersex Association site that you can look at, and so they have two problems. One problem is it usually had two, and that it wasn't clear how they were invited or not invited, and then also kind of the Eurocentrism, you know, so if you look at the nations that are represented, even on the medical practitioner side, it's very Eurocentric, so those were two issues. Yeah, I mean, one of the people that was there, Bo Laurent now, she was Cheryl Chase, that's her name now. And again, I mean, an incredible advocate, worked tirelessly, and still does, as a matter of fact, to give intersex people a voice. And so she was one of the invited people. And to what extent she speaks for intersex people.
How can any one person speak for an entire group is always difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, and one of the things that she's doing now, I think it's called the Interface Project, now is it's a whole project where just intersex people, you know, present their stories. And she was the founder of the ISNA. ISNA, come on, Terry. Society North America, so Intersex Society of North America.
Okay.
And if you go on the website, which is now no longer operative, but it's there, the whole thing was just getting people's stories out over and over and over again. So I think this is what is really important for advocates and advocacy work is here you have something where everybody is about listening to the voice of the marginalized, and yet at the end of the day, it doesn't happen. So then you have to look at institutional practices that are going on.
And so that actually brings up a question for me. So like you said, all of these groups were Eurocentric, and from hearing you speak about it, it sounds like there's a bit of paternalism that was going on here. Like, this group of people was deciding what we know is best for you, this marginalized group who we haven't really given much of a voice to. I tend to be somewhat cynical about these things, particularly institutional practices and how they reinforce oppression. You don't have to say that, but it just seems to me that that's kind of what was going on.
Well, I mean, the ISNA, and I'm a non-intersex person, and one question you asked me earlier, and I'd like to address that, is how I got interested in this research. So because this might come answer your question a little bit, but so I teach a university that's self-described as evangelical. And one of the things that was surprising me when I started was how much, you know, kind of traditional gender stereotyping was still very much in the air. And so that was surprising. And then I have a friend, a biologist, who, you know, talked to me about intersex children and, you know, families. And I you know, immediately I thought, what must it be like, you know, if you're, you know, if you're a person or in a family that's in a religious community where being male or female has so many expectations mm-hmm. of how you, and then all of a sudden, you know, you have a child or you are a person that even at the biological level, you don't fit into those classifications.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how I got interested in this work. And so I say that only to say that, so I came into starting to look at this stuff probably around 2005, right after the treatment protocol.
Mm-hmm.
So from my perspective, and there was like a Christian intersex website. So these organizations really were trying to give voice. They were intersex people themselves that had undergone a certain kind of treatment protocol that was horrific for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were speaking their own voice and providing a venue for others to speak of their experience.
Yes.
So I really think it was happening. And the thing was that the biomedical community started to listen.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like, yay! And then you get the outcome and you're like, oh my gosh, how could this have happened?
But I think that sort of stems from, again, maybe my own cynicism, that these are the things that ends up happening.
Well,
it seems good, and then
yeah.
the result ends up being more of the same.
Well, and I think, so paternalism, and where does that paternalism lie? I mean, I think I think the stories about these things are really complicated.
Mm.
I mean, certainly, and that was my talk at this conference, was you can certainly still see the way that the medical perspective is being privileged. At least that was my argument, that if you look at the, you know, the consensus statement and then subsequent now, especially impact studies, you know, the medical perspective is certainly still being dominant as opposed to the intersex perspective. And so that kind of paternalism,
mm-hmm.
you know, a kind of paternalism of the medical institution over its patients.
Mm.
I think that, and I mean, I just think that's just what's called, that, I mean, that's a big factor, that the medical institution, the relationship between the medical institution and quote-unquote patients, and even the rest of us, is one of extreme paternalism.
And so, last question then. Is there a way to fight that? Is there a way, what are the, if everything that was done sort of on the surface seemed to be at least, maybe not correct, but at least on the way to that, how do we resist this? Like, what do we do?
Okay, so I actually don't know, but I have two. Well, only because I don't think you ever know until you see what works.
Yeah,
But I think there's two things we can do. I think one, and it's funny because I think some of this Beaulieu work is kind of maybe an example of that in some sense, that there's two ways you can do this. One is when you've got institutions that are really, really powerful, yes, of course, it's important to try to get those institutions to listen to the marginalized voices and get them to hear,
mm-hmm.
right, so that they change. But I think at some point you just have to say screw them.
Mm-hmm.
And just start to look at other venues, right? That you just dodge around those institutions and try to bring the voice out rather than trying to get daddy, to use a paternalism,
mm-hmm.
to listen to you.
Yeah.
At some point, you just quit talking to daddy and you just start talking.
Well, I think that is a perfect place to end it then.
Okay.
I'm here once again with Terry Merrick, and I'm Poe Johnson signing off. Thank you and have a good day.